Support comes from the Arizona Inn, a four-diamond, family-owned historic resort hotel and restaurant on Elm Street near the U of A. Information is at arizonainn.com.
Hello, everyone. I'm Tucson Weekly Executive Editor Jim Nintzel, and I'm your host for Zona Politics here on Community Radio KXCI 91.3 FM. My guest today, U.S. Representative Raul Grijalva, who was first elected to Congress in 2002. Congressman Grijalva, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Jim. Appreciate it. And happy holidays to you.
You know, it has been a busy November in Washington with our first impeachment hearings in about two decades. The investigation is still unfolding, but what's your takeaway right now from what you've seen so far?
What we've seen so far, and I think one has to put that very important caveat in there, that all through the hearings, you never heard the facts or the testimony disputed. What you heard is attacks on the witnesses, other conspiracy theories about it was Ukraine and not Russia, second or third-hand information, and we need to know who the whistleblower is. But the issue of the whistleblower is that everything he put into that memorandum has been validated and verified by the 12 witnesses that have come that came before that committee. You know, I think there's a lot to do. I think, you know, the decision by the court today that McGahn has to is compelled to respond to the subpoena. And so that's another court fight, and I think that's an important one because Giuliani Pompeo, the chief of staff Mulvaney, and even Barr are all wrapped up in this thing, and they've all have information that would be useful for the American people for the committee. But there's been a real obstruction of those subpoenas. No information, no physical presence, no depositions, no emails. None of the subpoenaed information has come forth on the issue of presidential immunity and executive order. And so I think what we've seen is that there was an effort to extort from the president of Ukraine, the new president, a statement that they were going to investigate Joe Biden, his son, and the energy company Promisa in exchange for the release of the military funds, so close to $400 million, that Ukraine desperately need to hold off Russia as they continue to encroach on not only the territory, but you know, the whole functioning of the country of Ukraine, an independent sovereign nation. And at that point, you're risking national security. At that point, you're re-inviting a foreign power, like Russia was invited, to come and interfere with our own election in 2020. Yeah, I think that's pretty serious. And the denial of information or witnesses and the obstruction, I think that's obstruction of Congress. I think Schiff is right. Now it's time to do a final report that I am certain is going to recommend articles of impeachment. Send that to Judiciary Committee. Prepare those articles, and, you know, sometime before the major holidays of Christmas, that vote should be before the House. That's my anticipation of what's going to happen.
You had mentioned, well, let me ask you this. You had mentioned that you wanted to see those other guys testify, but clearly a court fight would drag that well into 2020. So you think the articles of impeachment can be drawn up without that testimony?
I think there's sufficient of both obstruction and the abuse of power in that office in terms of the deal and the extortion that was presented to the president and that he had to do to make a public declaration about an investigation, whether it happened or not, on what he saw as his biggest rival, which was Joe Biden, his son, and all those allegations that been already by intelligence community have been proven that didn't occur. But, you know, that hasn't stopped this administration, and I thought that there was no debate on the content. My Republican colleagues on the other side did character assassination. They tried to turn the issue around, but at the end of the day, you had 12 witnesses that essentially validated that what happened with regards to the quid pro quo did happen, and that I think that's sufficient.
I was really struck by the testimony of Marie Yovanovitch and what
Absolutely.
She was talking about in terms of and also what she was talking about in terms of the pressure campaign, but also the impact upon the State Department of having these sort of outside normal channels things going on and not supporting the professional staff there. Now, of course, Republicans are saying, well, he's the president of the United States. He directs foreign policy, and if these guys don't get in line, they ought to quit. And I'm just wondering how you respond to that.
I have the perspective I have for being there as long as I have. And whether it was Obama or Bush, there are certain norms and certain traditions and certain protocols that are followed, particularly with regards to international affairs. Those have all been violated one way or another with this current administration. And I don't, there's no perception of the danger that it's promoting. And to, you know, all of a sudden now try to promote the instigated idea by Russia that it was Ukraine that did all that interfering in the 2016 election is playing into the same narrative that Putin and Russia have been promoting, that it wasn't them, that it was Ukraine, when the intelligence agency, the CIA, the FBI, the Department of Defense have all said that what happened in 2016 was Russia and no one else.
And certainly a point underlined by Fiona Hill in her testimony last week. Let me shift gears away from the impeachment, because we'll obviously get back to that this week, and we'll see what happens now that you guys are headed back to work. But the House recently passed the Grand Canyon Centennial Protection Act to block new uranium mines, creating a permanent moratorium on new uranium mining claims on over 1 million acres of federally protected public lands to the north and south of Grand Canyon National Park. This is something you've been working on since 2008. Talk a little bit about why you thought this was important and what kind of threats the mining poses for the canyon on these lands.
Well, the moratorium was there and it was in place for another 11 years, okay? And during this period, studies were to be done about impacts on and off federal land, particularly in Navajo land, which has been devastated both in public health, but also in contamination of water, soil, air, and the abandoned mines that have not been cleaned up and continue to pose a danger. This analysis was going to be done. But the Trump administration immediately began to had a select committee of primarily uranium mining industries and other major energy companies did a task force to do what needed to be done in order to stimulate uranium mining in this country. And in doing so, I felt and many people felt that the threat was imminent, that the moratorium was a process established by President Obama, that he would undo it and then open up that whole region that has been in moratorium now for 9 years, since 2009. All of a sudden, we would have this situation where even though there's less than 1% of the uranium reserve is in those million acres, that it would suddenly open it up to uranium mining, which there's a danger to the watershed, a danger to the canyon itself, a danger to the life around it, and the big issue for Arizona and for the whole Southwest, a danger to the Colorado River. And so I thought that the urgency was once again high, and the bill passed the House with really good margin, and now we're awaiting Senator Sinema said she was going to do the companion legislation in the Senate, and then we'll go from there. It'll be tougher in the Senate, considering McConnell's there. You know, we have sent 300 pieces of legislation to the Senate, and the Republican majority there has yet to act on anything significant, from gun violence to Grand Canyon to infrastructure to reducing drug prices to voter integrity and protecting us from any other attacks on our voting on the election in 2020, criminal justice reform, and the list goes on and on. And not one action on it. Democrats only control the House of Representatives, and we have been producing legislation that we believe the American people want, and public opinion says that. Legislation on climate change has been passed, offshore drilling, et cetera. And it goes to the Senate, and McConnell won't deal with it. So if there is a sticking point is the Senate right now, who is doing nothing other than offering protection to the president.
And if you're just joining us, I'm your host, Jim Nintzel. This is Zona Politics, and we are talking with Congressman Raul Grijalva. Congressman Grijalva, as long as we're talking about mining, you know, a federal judge has rejected the Rosemont Mines plan in the Santa Rita Mountains on some pretty unique grounds. He said that the mine's Canadian owner isn't eligible to use the Forest Service lands as a dumping ground for the tailings because they don't plan to actually mine that particular area, so their application was invalid. Rosemont's trying to work around that with some new claims, but let me ask you this. Are you concerned about the federal agencies such as the EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers that appeared to be building a case against this project but then went ahead and gave it a green light under the Trump administration?
Oh, yeah. I think part of what we're going to establish in the Resources Committee, because we have made inquiries about Benetto and how that the initial report was changed under pressure. The same thing with Rosemont. We want to check why the discrepancy of initially holding back on permitting because of studies that are being done, assurances about water, assurances about contamination and waste removal, all those issues, and suddenly it's okay. And I think that what's happened to the agency, particularly the Interior, is that if you look at it, you know, beginning with Secretary Bernhardt and previous to him, Zinke, you know, they come from that industry. And many of the major players, the head of Bureau of Land Management and principal of political appointments all come from the gas and oil industry and from the extraction industry. And their agenda, not only the rollbacks and regulations, but which they've done plenty of, is to open up these lands as quickly as possible because they see the door shutting behind them in less than a year. And so I think the judge's decision, at least if it does nothing else, it buys the American people and buys Congress some time to be able to correct some of the things this administration's done. We are going to ask for subpoena power from the committee. I think that the majority on the Resources Committee will support it. Then I will have a subpoena power to compel the records and the witnesses that we have yet to receive, and that's the next step we're going to do, and that includes Rosemont as well.
You know, in a similar vein, you have a new bill, the Stop Giving Big Oil Free Money Act, which would increase the amount of royalties that companies have to pay when they extract resources from federal lands. Why did you think this was necessary?
You know, I thought the idea of waivers, which is what is being proposed, is on extraction primarily offshore, but just the idea of waivers because they can't guarantee a profit is unfortunately that's the price of doing business, and to roll back on any royalties I think is a huge mistake. Also, I think also addresses the issue of the subsidy that's provided in research and development, grid preparation, infrastructure support that the federal government has been giving the fossil fuel industry for many years. A similar support and supplemental support can be said for wind and alternative and or solar energy, for that matter, on any public lands. It's all the permits that have been accepted, less than 2% have been for alternative energy since the Trump administration came in. The rest has been for extraction. So, yeah, I think it's a necessary piece of legislation, if for nothing else, to raise that conversation.
I want to shift gears over to immigration, which I know is an important issue for you. And the Supreme Court is now reviewing whether the Trump administration properly ended the DACA program that allowed a qualifying undocumented youth to remain in America without threat of deportation. You've obviously been a big supporter of these Dreamers, as they've been called. I don't know what the courts are going to do, obviously, but DACA came about after President Obama realized that he wasn't going to get a legislative deal done to protect them. There seems to be an even more polarized Washington now, hard to believe, but it seems that way. What is the likelihood that Congress could pass a law protecting Dreamers that President Trump would sign?
We did. The House passed the law. It's, and at this point, that's all we got. The Senate won't deal with it. They won't even compromise in it. There hasn't been any conference committee asked to talk about it, even though they do have a bill. No vote has been asked for. I think it's going to be difficult. And even if it were to pass both, would the president ever sign it? When you have Miller whispering in his ear, his principal czar on immigration, who has developed all the policies and the separation policy, the Muslim ban, the remain in Mexico policy, all of them that are added to the aggravation that we find ourselves in the border and with immigration. And the links to that he has with the ideological support for white nationalism, he calls it white genocide. He's done that in the past, and that's the person driving this agenda. So, you know, the court decision is going to be critical, Jim. I mean, if they say the president has the ability to end it, we are going to jeopardize 600,000 to 700,000 people, young folks primarily, and their families. They won't be able to work. They won't be able to pursue their careers. And they have to go back into deep into the shadows again. And we've all we've done is taken a huge step backwards. You know, Obama didn't react to this issue as quickly as he should have. And I could see that. And we had a lot of lobbying and protests had to occur in order to move that needle. With this particular president, that kind of appeal does not work. That kind of lobbying does not work. And so he sees it as a campaign theme, immigration. He sees that as a key to keeping his base motivated and satisfied with him. And so, unfortunately, I see the situation becoming worse, as we see with the stay in Mexico policy, as we see a no movement on the issue of on a separate avenue dealing with the deported veterans that we have in Mexico and in other parts of the world. So it's going to be difficult. It's going to be the issue, and it's we just need to prepare for it and understand that that's going to be a consequence. And I worry about the Supreme Court decision, Jim, because anything less than upholding DACA is going to be very problematic for the community.
And if you are just tuning in, you're listening to Zona Politics. I'm your host, Jim Nintzel, and we are talking with Congressman Raul Grijalva. And Congressman, you just mentioned the Remain in Mexico policy, which forces asylum seekers to wait south of the border while their appeal is being heard. And you're not a big fan of this policy, are you?
No, I think, the issue is resources. The issue is credible fear. You know, this is not an automatic. And the sooner that we establish those issues of credible fear with people seeking asylum and refuge in this country, the better off we're going to be. But you can't limit the amounts. If you don't have the infrastructure to do this in terms of personnel and process and immigration judges, the bottleneck gets bigger and bigger. And to say remain in Mexico, is not going to solve the situation. Setting the transfer station here in Tucson for them to be sent to Juarez in order to wait in Mexico, that's not going to solve the situation. It puts a huge burden on a local community. But, you know, consequences are not an issue with this administration. I think it's just an added cruelty that's happened on the border with regard to immigration, and in particular with asylum seekers and those seeking refuge from persecution, whether it be religious, politically, or personal, you know.
And you mentioned also the whole question of deported veterans, and you've sponsored the Veterans Visa and Protection Act of 2019 so that undocumented veterans won't be deported. And talk about what's going on here and why this is necessary.
You have to approach this issue, and you almost have to separate it from the issue of immigration, although people have a hard time doing that, but you have to. These are men and women that served our country in uniform as volunteers, many of them saw combat. They came back home, and because they were nationalized citizens, they were permanent resident aliens, they had a green card. They didn't have the full protection of citizenship, so they did something wrong, and every one of them will admit. And 70% of those issues were dope, and 98% were nonviolent. They did their time in a state or federal or a local or a county detention center. Whatever the sentence was, they did it. Upon completing their sentence, they're picked up by ICE and deported to Mexico, the Philippines, etc., primarily to Mexico. And all we are saying in the legislation, for somebody that is a honorably discharged veteran, there should be a different category, and they should be separated and dealt with different, and be given an individual opportunity to deal with that question of not having the legal status as a citizen. Should have happened while they were in the service. It didn't. And every one of these men and women will say, I did something wrong, and I paid the price. But now I have a double price because I'm deported. I don't know this country. My family's all there. And these are young men and women from the present conflicts that we have to Vietnam. And it's indeed a tragedy. I've talked to veterans in Nogales, talked to veterans in Tijuana, Juarez, and it's all the same story, that they did something wrong, broke the law, paid the price, and now they're deported. And we want a separate category that deals with those individual veteran cases in a different way that allows them to stay in the country after they paid their debt to society and begin the process to make their status permanent and legal.
You know, while we're on the topic of the border, obviously we now have new sections of a border wall going up in Arizona, much to the dismay of some environmentalists who say the project managers are draining the local aquifers around these desert areas, sensitive aquifers, in order to make the cement for the wall. And in the longer term, they're cutting off access between the U.S. and Mexico for wildlife crossings and such. Is there any stopping this wall construction?
Well, you know, the Supreme Court gave Trump, unfortunately, a source of money when they okayed that he could divert the Department of Defense money for the wall. But, you know, even if you talk about all the rhetoric, you know, it's been minimal. It's been the replacement of existing facilities in terms of what's been constructed, and most of it on public land because they can waive all the rules. When you get to parts of Texas and other parts where they're in court on eminent domain issues, and they've been in court for up to 8 years, beginning with the Bush administration, more than that, and with the Obama administration, that becomes a little more difficult. That taking is much more difficult. I really think that what we're doing is the effect on the environment and the economies of border communities is negative. That's already known. The effectiveness of this wall is minimal at best, and non-existent, and doesn't really change the dynamics of who unauthorized people coming into this country. So, you know, it's not effective, but the effect is very negative. And what could be done? I think, you know, the House continues, but we do have the budget, and continues not to fund it in our categories. But like I said, Supreme Court gave him the opportunity to go to another source of money, which is the Department of Defense.
You know, there is a lot of talk among the progressive candidates and some presidential candidates about Medicare for all. Do you think we should abolish private health insurance and move everyone onto a government system?
I'm for universal health care. I support Medicare for all. I think there's a transition period that people should not, you know, you're not going to turn the light on and off in one afternoon, and all of a sudden, every American, that we've done the duty of getting health care to every person because it's their right. I think there's a transition period. I think that we need to make accommodations for those employer-based firms that people want to stay there. But the transition period, to me, and the fact that Medicare for All would be strengthened, and that people that enroll there, I think that would be a process of, like happened with ACA, that the growth in Medicare for All would be huge. But you have to provide resources to Medicare for All. You have to begin to make that not only affordable, but appealing to people to join. And I think that can be done. But I think conceptually, I support it. I think the practical application of how that happens is more pragmatic and in a transition period than switching the light off and on.
So I wanted to see what your take was on President Trump's decision to pull the U.S. troops from Syria and allow Turkey to launch an invasion targeting the Kurds who have been our allies against ISIS.
I thought that was a knee-jerk decision. It went against the advice of the chiefs of staff, but this is a knee-jerk decision that really enhanced Turkey's role in that area. And the dictator in Syria is strengthened, and the people that are victimized and are in the most jeopardy are the Kurds that were our principal allies that lost 13,000 of their troops in joining with the United States to fight ISIS and to retake that area that formerly had been under control by ISIS and the Islam. So what was the net gain of that? Nothing. And you found the reaction from the House was immediate, condemning that move. But more importantly, something that I've been there has never been passed with any significance, where the House voted in large numbers calling out what happened to Armenians as genocide, and it should be treated as genocide. In the past, in deference to the diplomatic issue of Turkey, many members would never vote for that. This time, based on the president's action, which was callous and not long-term and not in our best interest, and certainly not in the best interest of Israel, if that was one of the reasons it was done. So here we find ourselves now in a situation that is going to morph into something worse and begin to pull on the United States to have a larger presence there, when the issue has always been, how do we reduce our presence there? I think that rash decision is going to cost us more in terms of money and hopefully not in lives.
All right. Well, that is all the time we have, Congressman. There's so much more to talk about, but we'll have to leave it there. I thank you so much for joining us, and I want to wish you and your family a very happy holiday.
Thank you. You too, my friend. Bye.
That is our show for today. I'd like to thank Congressman Raul Grijalva for joining us to talk about those issues. I'd also like to thank the gang here at Community Radio KXCI 91.3 FM for their support, especially my producer, Bridget Thumb. And I'd like to thank all of you for listening as you wind down your Thanksgiving weekend. I'm very thankful for all of you. We'll see you next week.
Support for Zona Politics is provided by Hotel Congress in historic downtown Tucson. Hotel Congress is known for its world-famous taproom, cup cafe, and Club Congress, offering local and national acts inside and outside on the plaza. More information at hotelcongress.com and 622-8848. Zona Politics is made possible with the generous support of The Loft Cinema, Tucson's independent movie theater. The Loft features independent, foreign, and documentary films, cult classics, discussions with filmmakers, and much more, including the Loft Film Fest in November. The Loft is located at 3233 East Speedway Boulevard. Showtimes can be found at loftcinema.org.